You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 22nd of April 2024 on Monocle Radio.
The first high-profile Israeli resignation over the security failures of October 7th. Will it be the last? Another barrage of North Korean missile tests? Is it just noisy and expensive attention-seeking? And Milan proposes to clean the streets of after-hours ice cream slurpers. I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests, Julie Norman and John Everard, will discuss the day's big stories, and we'll meet the artist who has dressed up one of London's best-known brutalist landmarks. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I am joined today by Julie Norman, lecturer in politics and international relations at UCL and co-director of the UCL Centre on US Politics, and by John Everard, former British ambassador to Belarus, Uruguay and North Korea. Hello to you both.
Hello.
John, you will be, well, you have been rather off on one of your zany cycling adventures, which will be relatively familiar to our listeners. You have, as I understand it, been cycling through hailstorms to get to Manchester. Is this some sort of oblique commentary on the fact that such is the state of British railways, this is actually the quickest and most comfortable way to get there?
No, I wouldn't claim it's actually quicker even than British trains, even at
really?
Their worst. Really? No, I cycle because I like cycling. Are the hailstorms a comment on something? Quite possibly. I mean, there are moments out there in the open, you know, with hailstones bouncing off my bicycle, bouncing off my helmet, that I felt a bit of Lear on the blasted heath, like. But we got there in the end.
How long does it take to cycle London to Manchester?
3 days. Stopped in Northampton, then Derby, then Manchester.
I reckon you would give most trains currently at the moment, certainly those leaving Euston, a bit of a run for their money. And of course, it doesn't cost you £700 to stand all the way.
No, that's true. It's free. You get sort of rather numb legs, but you don't pay the fare.
Swings and roundabouts.
Yes.
Julie, you have been to the United States and you are going to China, I'm guessing that you didn't cycle or are not cycling to either.
Not quite, yes. Though I do think that that John should get some kind of like rickshaw business going up to Manchester. I think he could make a good side gig on that. But no, I was home over the Easter break visiting family in Utah in the D.C. area, and then heading over to China, so doing my best to mend U.S.-China relations these days with my travels.
Excellent. Actually, there is an idea there, John. I think if you turned up at Euston on like one of those tandem bicycles and just sort of like offered to rent out the rear seat, I think you'd get takers on an especially desperate evening.
Don't tempt me.
Well, we will have more from both of you shortly. But first, here in the UK, the government still remains manically determined that spending a fantastic sum of taxpayers' money on flying a few dozen asylum seekers to Rwanda may spare them the electoral apocalypse forecast by polls. Parliament is being called upon to pass the Safety of Rwanda Bill, one provision of which, clue in the name, is a legal insistence that Rwanda is in fact safe. Fun fact, last year the UK granted asylum to 15 people from Rwanda. I'm joined now from the House of Commons by George Parker, political editor at the Financial Times. George, is tonight, assuming the government clambers over it, actually the final hurdle?
Let's hope so. I mean, it's been dragging on for 2 years since the government first announced this idea of sending asylum seekers to Rwanda, and we've been going through about 4 months since the government announced emergency legislation. But yes, it does feel like tonight's the night. We're going to have this round of so-called ping-pong between the two chambers in the House of Parliament, the House of Commons and the House of Lords. And the idea is that through this attritional game, sometime this evening, possibly after midnight, who knows, the House of Lords will eventually give up and accept that as the unelected House, it's got to give way to the will of the elected House of Commons. And so sometime tomorrow, we expect this bill to be heading towards His Majesty for royal assent.
I mean, is that actually inevitable? Is there any chance from where we are now that the Lords find another way to scupper this, or it kind of scuppers itself?
I think at the end of the day, the House of Lords will give way. They do feel very strongly about this in the upper house. There are two amendments being discussed. One would basically set up a monitoring mechanism to ensure that Rwanda remains a safe country to send asylum seekers to. The other one's intended to stop people who helped the British Army in Afghanistan, interpreters, for example, from being deported to Rwanda. They feel very strongly about those amendments. But in the end, the House of Lords generally knows its place. And what you would expect to see through the course of the evening is the number of members of the House of Lords turning up to vote in a series of votes will diminish. People will maybe head off for dinner. Some people go to their gentlemen's clubs up in St. James's, and eventually the government will get its way. That's what we expect to happen anyway.
George, if you could explain to our doubtless somewhat bewildered international listeners why the government of the United Kingdom has spent 2 years on this, and not just 2 years, but really quite tremendous amounts of money, do they think this is actually going to work in terms of stopping boat-borne asylum seekers, or are we in the realm of something must be done, this is something, therefore we must do it?
Well, if you listen to Rishi Sunak, who gave a press conference in Downing Street today, he's absolutely convinced this will be a game changer. This will deter people from making the treacherous journey across the English Channel in small boats. They will be so worried about being dispatched to Rwanda when they arrive. You speak to other people privately in the Conservative government who thinks this won't work. This is what the Labour Party essentially calls a gimmick. And we know last year about 30,000 people crossed the English Channel in boats. The number of people who might be sent to Rwanda, we probably expect to be somewhere in the hundreds. And so the question is, how much of a deterrent is it really to people who are prepared to gamble with their lives and making that very dangerous crossing, a fairly remote chance they'll be sent to Rwanda? So, yes, I mean, the government feels it has to do something. It's a big issue at the general election, which is coming up later this year. And this is what they've come up with. But frankly, do people really think it's going to work? I think there's an awful lot of scepticism.
Just finally on that, will it actually work, George? Do we know yet if they will be able to find literally anybody willing to put on the flights? This is one of the problems that it has been suggested to various airlines, that they may be in breach of various international treaties and acts if they cooperate with this.
Well, Rishi Sunak said today that they had managed to find commercial charter companies to provide aircraft for this. But it's going to bring an awful lot of reputational risk to the company providing the planes. The United Nations, for example, has advised people not to take part in these flights. We reported at the Financial Times that Rwanda Air, the national carrier of Rwanda, refused to take part because of fear of reputational damage. So, yes, Rishi Sunak says he is confident they'll have the planes and the airfields and the staff to carry out this operation. But we'll wait and see. I mean, like a lot of these things, we want to see the proof, really, and we've been waiting for quite a long time to see it.
George Parker at the Financial Times at the House of Commons. Thank you for joining us. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle Radio. Let's bring in our panel now, Julie Norman and John Everard, and let's look at Israel. While responsibility for the Hamas massacres of October 7th should obviously be apportioned to those who conceived, directed and conducted them, there has been reasonable disquiet among Israelis to the effect that their well-resourced military and intelligence services should have seen it coming. A pertinent sword has at last been fallen on. Major General Aharon Haliva, commander of the IDF's Military Intelligence Directorate, has resigned. His organisation, he said, did, quote, not live up to the task we were entrusted with. Julie, there were at the time a lot of calls among Israelis for resignations and accountability, because it is obviously about as glaring a security screw-up as might be imagined. But is it actually in the circumstances fair enough that nobody quit at the time? The reasoning being, OK, we will get to that, but right now we do need people in place to respond to an emergency.
I think that was definitely part of the thinking. And even with Haliva, I mean, he came out with a statement, I think about 10 days after the attack, kind of saying a mea culpa, but also not obviously actually resigning until we see this point in the war now. And I do think that has been the thinking behind at least the military and the defense establishment, that, you know, have recognized some fault, but are also saying, OK, we are in the midst of a war here. You need some continuity. Now that the war is at this inflection point, I think we can expect to see a few more of these resignations. At the end of the day, though, politically, we have not heard those kinds of mea culpa statements from Netanyahu or any other politician, really. And I think that's what really will make or break the sense for many Israelis of some kind of ownership from the government.
John, do you think there will be or should be more? I mean, as Julie Shortley was saying, people have issued mea culpas, among them the IDF Chief of Staff, Lieutenant General Herzi Halevi, the Shin Bet Director Ronan Barr. They have both taken an amount of blame, but have said that we will stay while this war is being fought. Do you anticipate an exodus, as it were?
Yes, quite possibly, but probably not until hostilities cease, and who knows when that's going to be. Khalifa, of course, originally said that he would wait until the end of the war before resigning himself, although he's now contradicted that and gone a bit earlier. The big question, as Julie quite rightly points out, is whether in the layer above that, in the political sphere, we have to get resignations. And I see people sort of holding on to political doorknobs with their fingernails, desperate to stay in office regardless. I think one of the big elements that's come out of today's events is the very clear call for a full state investigation into what went wrong. I mean, I'm so old that I can remember the investigation into the Yom Kippur War and the devastation that wrought in Israeli politics as it became clear that there'd be mass incompetence at almost all levels of the Israeli government. The other one into the Shatila massacre had the same effect. If this is unleashed, then nobody from Netanyahu down is safe. And I suspect that Netanyahu will fight this idea in the last trench.
Well, indeed so. But on the subject of Netanyahu and the idea of political accountability, Julie, if there is a wave of resignations from the intelligence and the military services, possibly Israel being Israel, who knows, a coordinated wave of resignations from the intelligence and military services, where I suspect Netanyahu rather struggles for fans these days, does it make his position untenable if he's the guy at the top and he's saying, well, I'm not going to quit?
Well, I think if there's one thing that we've seen from Netanyahu is he finds ways to hang on. And he's certainly, I think, using the war to that advantage right now. And I would say there's already been tension, so to speak, between many in the military and intelligence establishment and Netanyahu and the war cabinet because of the lack of strategy being used in the war, while the military said, you know, tactically, we've been doing what we need to do, but there needs to be some strategy from above. So I think as these resignations come in, it's going to shine the light even more broadly, harshly, so to speak, on Netanyahu, who's already very unpopular in Israel right now, more for his handling of things before the war than during them.
I mean, John, whenever something akin to this occurs, there is always an amount of blame directed at intelligence services, and they do always have the retort to the effect that, look, we can't be everywhere, we can't follow up everything, we can't be right all the time. But it is one thing, is it not, to, I guess, kind of not take seriously some fantastically improbable-sounding plan of suicide bombers flying aircraft into skyscrapers in New York City versus a huge offensive conducted by an organization which you know is right next door and which you know wants to destroy you and which you're supposed to have penned in under more or less complete comprehensive surveillance.
Yes, to all that. It's made much worse by the fact that individually, of course, Khalifa was on holiday in Eilat when on October the 7th, and he was telephoned and warned that a Hamas attack appeared to be imminent and didn't do anything about it. He'll live with that for the rest of his life.
It is absolutely extraordinary, and we will doubtless learn more about this as and when investigations occur. But just a final quick one on this, Julie, pertaining to the United States. There are reports that the US is going to sanction one particular battalion of the IDF, the Netzi Yehuda Battalion, possibly other military and police units which have been suspected of behaving fairly atrociously in Gaza. That would be quite a big deal, wouldn't it?
It would be a very big deal, and Israel is pushing back very hard at this move. It's one that I think Biden and Secretary of State Blinken were somewhat reluctant to have to do, but they've been pushed by many within the United States to have a bit more accountability. And I would point out that this particular unit, the allegations that they're looking into are actually pre-October 7th. Most of them are actions that took place in the West Bank, a Palestinian-American elderly man who died after being in their custody, et cetera, back from over a year ago. So these are long-standing issues with this particular unit that the U.S. is really just being forced, I would say, to confront and deal with now. But if these sanctions do go through, it will be a big step for the United States, even though it may not seem so to outside observers.
Well, let's move along to John's former bailiwick of North Korea, which has resumed tormenting the fish of the Sea of Japan, firing what appears to have been several short-range ballistic missiles into the water over the weekend. And /but also claims to have tested what North Korea describes as a super-large warship. forehead. Not large, but super large. Official North Korean channels declared intriguingly that a certain goal was attained, without going into specifics. John, translate from the North Korean, if you would. What does a certain goal was attained mean?
They have managed to fire off a warhead of the same dimensions and weight as a nuclear warhead. They've established that they can actually deliver nuclear weapons with cruise missiles. This is bad news.
Who is the presumed audience for this, though? Is it basically everybody?
It's the wider West. It's the Republic of Korea, South Korea, mm-hmm. Which, of course, has now been denounced by North Korea as not really Korean brothers anymore, as a separate state, which opens the way legally, judicially, within North Korea for them to renew the Korean War, to complete the revolution. And, of course, to the Korean people, who've had a tough few years. Living standards have gone backwards quite sharply. The pandemic lockdown hurt a lot of people, and they need some kind of good news from their government.
Is it possible, Julie, I'm just hanging this one out there, that what with the world's attention being consumed by the Middle East and Ukraine and various other crises, North Korea's kind of missing being at the centre of it all?
I do think there's something to that, saying, look, we're still here, kind of waving arms. But to that point also, I mean, this is not the first launch that we've seen from North Korea in recent months. There have been, you know, others in recent times as well that I think is part of just the ongoing posturing in the region. And I think, as John rightly said, part of this is for domestic audiences, partly is for the region, and partly is also a sort of flex to the U.S. and to other Western powers who are really still doing a lot of maneuvering in the Indo-Pacific, even as most eyes are on Ukraine and the Middle East. And North Korea, I think, is very aware of those changing dynamics.
The big hope is that that is all it is. This is just North Korea posturing, wanting the limelight and so on. But I think the big fear is that it's much, much worse than that. Remember that not so long ago, April the 10th, Kim Jong-un was photographed in front of a model of Seoul talking about a real war and they need to prepare it. He still has to complete his grandfather's legacy. He still has to liberate South Korea from the imperialist American jackboot. And to do this, because his conventional forces are such a mess, and because also he's given most of his munitions to Russia, he needs to use nuclear weapons. What we're looking at is the serious risk of nuclear weapons being used in anger for the first time since 1945, probably in a surprise attack, probably using the kind of delivery vehicles that we've just been talking about, large cruise missiles, short-range ballistic missiles, to destroy key South Korean and American assets on the peninsula and swarm across before anybody can respond.
The inevitable follow-up to that, John, though, and we have discussed such nightmare scenarios before, but does the North Korean leadership not quite apprehend that anything of that ilk they did would be the last thing they ever did?
Do you think that's true?
I think it probably is, isn't it?
I'm not so sure, and I don't think they're so sure either. I think they believe that the United States is feeble, lacks courage, and that what they need to do is to combine a tactical nuclear attack on South Korean targets with a plausible threat of obliterating a United States city if the United States intervenes, and that will stay America's hand. I hope we never find out whether they're right.
Julie, is it also possible that they, like one or two other somewhat unsavory regimes around the world, are trying to time their run with whatever it is pending the decision your fellow citizens make in November? Because presumably, Kim Jong-un et al. Would be quite happy for a Donald Trump restoration.
Absolutely. I think we're seeing a lot of sort of hedging, testing the waters this year as we get closer to the election and trying to push the envelope with different countries saying, look what we're willing to, you know, as John was rightly saying, look what we're willing to show that we can do. And we're kind of testing the U.S., whether it's Biden or whether it's Trump, to say, you know, we are all watching this election. And if the U.S. looks like it's retreating from the global stage, these are, you know, areas that we may take things into our own hands. And I think that's important for Americans to take into account.
Just a couple of other factors which I wonder, John, may be figuring in North Korean thinking. First, there's the fact that South Korea has become more attached, I guess, to Western security architecture in the last couple of years. We've seen their leaders going to NATO summits. We've seen enormous orders placed for South Korean kit, especially from Poland, especially for the K2 Black Panther tank, the FA-50 attack jet. And there's also the fact that Russia, as I understand it, has somewhat scuppered the monitoring of UN UN sanctions of North Korea, because North Korea and Russia are now friends, isn't in that North Korea is supplying Russia with things it needs to fire at the Ukrainians. Do the North Koreans feel, I guess, emboldened in one direction and yet ever more paranoid in the other, which is not a happy combination?
They certainly feel emboldened. I mean, Kim Jong-un has made clear he thinks he's on a roll. He thinks that this new loving with Russia is the answer to many of his prayers. He's getting oil, grain, all kinds of goods from Russia, and quite clearly a lot of technical help. Either the North Koreans have been extremely clever over the last few months, or somebody has been slipping them blueprints. Paranoid? I think the regime is a lot less paranoid than people think. I don't think he really worries about an attack by the United States. This is just bluster for public consumption. But I think he's coming to believe that he can actually now overrun South Korea.
And just finally going back to the United States on this again, Julie, is it surprising that Joe Biden has seemed unenthused about certainly following up the Donald Trump variety of direct outreach to the North Korean regime?
Yeah, I think it's something that, you know, is always considered in the United States with how much do you engage versus not. And I think for the United States this time around with this administration, it was more of this sense of trying to balance against China in the whole region, trying to bring Japan closer, trying to bring South Korea closer, trying to create these new relationships between those countries. You know, summits last week with the Philippines, really just trying to double down on relationships within the region rather than trying to develop something new with North Korea. And that seemed to be their stance to approach both North Korea and China collectively.
Well, on a lighter subject entirely, to Milan, and grim tidings for those wishing to participate in the traditional local ritual of consuming a late-night snack while bellowing at deafening volume between the hotel window of a visiting journalist and why, yes, I speak from an amount of personal experience. City authorities have proposed banning the sale of takeaway food after midnight and closing the outdoor areas of bars and restaurants at a relatively respectable hour in the interests of cracking down on unruly nightlife and permitting those Milanese who wish to get some sleep. John, first of all, interestingly, the row over this in Milan, and it does appear to be spectacular, has coalesced very much around ice cream. The genuine grief that people may not be permitted to consume ice cream on the street in the early hours of the morning.
You sound surprised. I mean, if I were denied the right to eat ice cream at 8 out of the day at night, I too would be outraged, especially not in the Milanese summer. Besides, does slurping ice cream really make so much noise?
It's not so much in my recollection the slurping of the ice cream as the conversational accompaniment.
Yes, but if you're actually slurping ice cream, you're not talking, are you? At least I never managed the trick.
The people under my hotel window were finding a way to do both at once.
I am deeply impressed. I've always worked on the assumption that if you're using your mouth for consumption rather than conversation, that the other possibilities are excluded and probably quiets things down. I mean, firstly, as an ice cream lover, full disclosure, this cuts me to the quick, the idea that ice cream might be restricted. Secondly, we've been here before. I've been trying to remember which US city it was that tried exactly the same, and it all went horribly wrong because they discovered that if you stop people eating, and not just ice cream, but, you know, the other things that Americans like to eat late at night, all that happens is that they go around the streets being noisy in any case and don't sort of sit down and have meals together. They just keep stomping around and get bored, and you get problems of delinquency.
Well, I think even Milan had the same issue. They said, like,
they
10
did.
Years ago, like 2013. And this was, like, I think they said there was this whole movement called, like, Occupy Gelato.
That's gotta be,
like, the best protest movement ever that I would totally sign up for. And so I think they're up for
exactly.
this again.
Don't you just love Italy?
Oh, my gosh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, I speak, Julie, as regular listeners will be aware, as a massive lifelong fan of Italy. And I also, too, John, controversially, am a big fan of ice cream. But there is an eternal tension here, Julie, between people who want to enjoy the nightlife of a city and people who do also want to get a night's sleep. It strikes me that the proposals being adumbrated by the Milanese authorities for certainly for outdoor hospitality, I mean, this sounds liberal-ish. They're talking about closing outdoor areas of bars and restaurants at 12:30 on weekdays and 1:30 in the morning on weekends. I mean, it's not unreasonable, is it?
Yeah, I do kind of wonder who, like, some of the quotes, like the little families that are out at like 1 a.m. am getting ice cream and these kinds of things. But yeah, I would just say to you, I am also an ice cream lover. Hidden scoop, get it? But I do think like that's probably the least of their worries. I could see like banning some of the sales of other things, but I agree. I think ice cream is something that would like sedate the masses a little bit rather than rile them up.
I mean, is there anything that is... Well, is there actually anything to be done about this, John? The Secretary General of the Local Retailers Association, I think, put it quite well. He said, do you think a 25-year-old is going to go home at the stroke of midnight simply because they can't get a takeout? What about the tourists who want to eat ice cream after midnight? I mean, it's kind of what you were saying earlier. People who want to make noise will still find a way to make noise.
Yes, absolutely. I do feel for the residents whose sleep is disturbed and, of course, for visiting journalists whose importance to sleep is disturbed by people going around loudly slurping ice cream and talking at the same time, as I've learned it's now possible, and other bunches. We've learned to tomp away on pizzas and clack away at pasta. But I really don't think that this kind of clampdown on the catering trade late at night actually stops the noise. Noise is going to be there anyway. The only way you're going to stop it is by banning people from those streets after a certain time, a curfew. Are you really going to do that?
Well, no, because then, Julie, I guess, and this is also the problem with rules like this, is that somebody then has to enforce them.
That's right. I would not want to have to go out and battle someone trying to get their ice cream. That's all I have to say. So,
well, as a final, more cheerful thought, then, I did want to ask you each in turn, like, what's your actual favourite flavour of either ice cream or gelati? And there is no way I would ever be able to find the shop in question, the gelateria in question in Siena, but dear Lord, it was the thick end of a quarter of a century ago, and I can still remember the amaretto flavored gelati. Absolutely astonishing.
I love amaretto, but honeycomb.
Honeycomb
ice cream, yeah.
Niche. I can see that, actually.
Yeah, it is really pretty good.
Julie?
I'm a big nut person, so I like the pistachio, the hazelnut.
Do like a pistachio.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Amaretto is also up there, though, and a little bit of chocolate mixed in sometimes. Mm-mm-mm.
Okay, I know what we all feel like now. Julie Norman and John Everard, thank you for joining us. Finally on today's show, Ibrahim Mahama is the artist behind Purple Hibiscus, which has wrapped London's Barbican building in more than 2,000 metres of magenta fabric decorated with tribal robes, known as Batakari. Constructed in Ghana by over 1,000 artists, this work is Mahama's most ambitious and highlights his ambition for African artists to capture global attention. He is someone uniquely placed to reflect on the current situation of African art and his role in developing an internal market for it to remain in the continent. Monocle Radio's George Ruskin sat down with him at the Barbican.
Ibrahim Mahama, thank you so much for joining me and talking to Monocle Radio. We're in the building where your amazing installation, Purple Hibiscus, is draped all around us. It's looking sensational. I was going to say even on a day like today, but I think it's especially on a day like today, because I know that the juxtaposition between the beautiful pink colour of the installation and the grey skies of London was something that you thought about in the conception.
Yes, I did. The entire work started off as a joke, the pink colour, because I've always made work that has this subtlety around it, like the tone. It's always grey, darkish, brownish colours. And then when I was invited to look at the building, the history of the site, which used to be a place where rugs were traded, and then later on the Barbican was built on top of it. And of course, this very brutalist building, something which is almost supposed to be indestructible. So I was looking at the facade, the architecture, the concrete, and I thought, maybe for once I should be courageous enough to throw some bright colour on the building due to the facades that I've been working on.
I want to take you back to Tomale, your home city in Ghana. How was your development as an artist in that city?
Well, I didn't grow up in Tomale, you know. I was born there in 87, and 2 years afterwards, I found myself in Accra with my mom and my siblings. And yeah, grew up there ever since. I went to high school in the south in a town called Koforidua, and then I later went to the Kwame Nkrumah University of Science and Technology. That's where most things became more concrete. In uni, I met my mentors, professors and friends, colleagues. One of our professors, George, he came to England to study and then came back to Ghana to volunteer his time at the university. I was in the third year, and that was the first time I heard about the white cube, the concept of the white cube, about institutions and how they operate, how works are shown. I finished, went back to do my MFA. I think that was the best decision I ever made in my life, to do this MFA. And that's where I started experimenting and doing many other things that led me to London in 2013, Gasworks, and 14, the first international show that I participated in, which was at the Saatchi Gallery. And I remember I came here that year, exactly 10 years ago. I came to the Barbican to sit by the Lakeside Terrace and just with a friend to chat, and we came to see a retrospective. And I never imagined that in 10 years I'll be doing this project here.
Despite all your international success, you're still firmly rooted in Tamale. You've given so much back to that city artistically. You've constructed three culture centres there. Talk me through those, what they do for the community, and how you went about constructing them and founding such institutions.
Well, I remember one of my professors said to me, why not build a studio in Tamale if you want to practice art? Imagine how many kids you can influence through your work. And I said, oh, it sounds quite clever. Let's see what it becomes. So in 2014, my first work was sold to the Saatchi. That was the money that I invested into starting to build the Savannah Center for Contemporary Art. I realized that a lot of the work that we do as African artists from the Global South always ends up in Western collections. How do we bring those works into the local context that people can grow up with? And lastly was the Nkrumah Vualini, which was an old brutalist building built in the post-independence era, connected to Pan-Africanist economic freedom. And it was abandoned in 1966 during the Cold War, when Nkrumah was accused of building nuclear bunkers, things like that. So I had to buy it in order to be able to convert it into a contemporary art institution. There are a lot of artists in Ghana, like, who in our generation, I think that there's been this strong evolution, because I think artists are beginning to realize that they need to somehow form collectives and alliances in order to be able to help each other, and also ways in which they can recreate studios that can help their colleagues and other people grow. But I think with regards to subject matter, there is still quite a lot of work to do with regards to, let's say, the form that art takes. I think that is one thing that we are still somehow trying to understand with regards to what forms art take. Can art always be thought of as a painting, or can it be thought of as a textile or a sculpture or whatever? I think that the amalgamation or combination or contradictions are things that we're still somehow trying to understand.
What does your creative process look like?
So I spend a lot of time at home, like going to sites, going to scrapyards, looking for objects and materials. I bring them to the studio. I have a huge storage space. I just keep them and I take photographs of them. I put them in the field. I take drone shots of them with my camera. And then I'll be looking at them again and again. And one day, eureka, something strikes in your mind. Like, aha, there was something about the texture or the pattern that I never paid attention to. So for me, the process of work is not just being in the studio and producing. It's also the idea that in my studio, it's an open place where every day we have like hundreds of visitors coming, school children, 200 to 500 kids. What do you do with them? How do you engage them in the process of art? By taking them around, talking to them about architecture, the building, the archive, the artworks, which might have been in a museum in Canada, they're seeing one in the local context. After all, these are objects that they are familiar with, but on a normal level, they wouldn't have encountered it if an artist didn't build an institution. So for me, the process of art becomes more interesting in that sense, because in the process of disseminating an idea through an object or a series of objects that you've transformed or even worked on, it somehow also inspires you differently. Because imagine you trying to explain a work that is in, let's say, the Museum of Modern Art or in Tate or something to local kids in a village somewhere. And then you have to rethink about language. If you're speaking local language like Dagbani, what we do, and then maybe one of our caretakers, maybe the security man, he has to explain it to them because he's also engaged in the work. And he has to explain it to them in the local language. Imagine what happens in that process. There is an entire world that is opened up in that process. So he might find ways to describe it in the local language using certain stories that you as an artist would have never thought about. So all those things are part of the processes. It also inspires you differently to think about how people can live with art, can possess art, because contemporary art is full of contradictions. I think it's all those contradictions and how we engage with it. That is where art for me becomes very interesting.
I'd like to talk about your reflections on the African art industry and how that's changed over the course of your career so far and where you think it's heading?
Well, I think African art has been growing quite a lot significantly, either through exhibitions, major exhibitions, retrospectives, publications, or auctions, things like that. For me, I've always thought that, if anything, we should focus more on investing into building different types of structures or institutions that can even allow for this growth to be sustained in a way, not just in terms of artists, but in terms of audiences, and also in terms of, let's say, supporters of art, either collectors or other things. Because at the end of the day, you realize that on the continent, there aren't many supporters of artists' works or artistic projects. Most of the support comes from the West still. And then it will be more sustainable if there is a generation of young people who can grow up to be supporters of art. But it starts by education, by allowing a generation to understand the significance of art and culture. And then one day when they get themselves involved in other businesses and things like that, they can support art.
That was Ibrahim Mahama speaking to George Ruskin. And that is all for this edition of The Monocle Daily. Thanks to our panellists today, Julie Norman and John Everard. Also to George Parker at the top of the show. Today's show was produced by Christy O'Grady and researched by George Ruskin. Our sound engineer was Tamsin Howard, with editing help from Flynn Simons. I'm Andrew Mullett here in London. The Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.